Hello, I'm Steve Bloomfield, and this is The Big Interview on Monocle 24. My guest today began his journalism career 50 years ago at the BBC, and he's still there today. During the past five decades, he's travelled to more countries than many could name, interviewed countless presidents and rebel leaders, and witnessed more globe-changing events than almost anyone before or since. He was there in Tiananmen Square. He was there when the Berlin Wall fell. He was there when Mandela was released. He was in Baghdad when the Iraq War began, in Belgrade during the NATO bombing, in Afghanistan as the Taliban fell. He's still there now, even at the age of 72. Last month, he was in Mosul reporting on the fight against ISIS. He is, of course, John Simpson, the BBC's World Affairs editor, and he joins us here in Midori House today. John Simpson, welcome to Monocle 24 and The Big Interview.
It's very nice to be here.
You have been working at the BBC for 50 years now.
Don't remind me, come on.
Well, you mentioned it early on in your book, so I feel I should bring it up. But look, rather than going through all the changes at the BBC, I wondered perhaps if you could explain to us the difference between how you filed your first story out in the field all those many moons ago, and how you filed your most recent story.
Well, I mean, in purely technical terms, it was completely different. As far as I remember, I don't actually remember how I filed my first story, but I'm sure that I did it. I had some sort of black box and a big microphone, and I or somebody else cleverer than I fixed it up to the phone line. As far as I remember, you took the housing off the phone microphone. You unscrewed it and plugged in a couple of the wires and hoped that nobody from the hotel came in as you were doing it. And, of course, you know, phones are different in every country. So you go to France or Italy or something and it wasn't possible to do it. And then you had to fiddle around with the wires in the wall. Now it's just so easy. I've got an app on my phone. I mean, dead easy, absolutely. If things have got easier in most ways, but the job remains the same and it's still a difficult job. Doesn't matter how easy it is to actually put the stuff over, it's still a hard business and your heart beats faster and you feel that much more relieved when you've finished.
Why is it a hard business? Why is it a hard job, as you say?
Yeah, I mean, there are other reasons why it's hard, political reasons, the way that things have changed. But in terms of actually sort of getting the stuff over, it's hard for two reasons, really. One, that time is always short and you're always racing to do something or another. No matter what it is, no matter, you know, how easy it becomes to broadcast, you still don't have enough time to do it. And the other thing is that nowadays, compared with 50 or less years ago, everybody knows everything. Everybody with a laptop can know exactly what's happening all over the world, especially where you are. But somehow or another, some sort of malign magic makes it that you never quite know what the latest is on the story that you're doing. So they know and you don't.
Well, on that point, in terms of, you know, how things have changed now, that issue of, you know, the fact that everyone knows what's going on in the world, do you worry that actually we no longer look to, you know, the voices of wisdom that we might have 20, 30 years ago, because we can all turn on our phones and get the news from anywhere at any time?
Well, I mean, I think people do seem to be kind of sceptical about or sick of experts. I think Michael Gove, when he said that much criticised thing during the Brexit campaign, I think there is a certain amount of truth in that. And I think a lot of people do feel that experts shouldn't be listened to anymore, that anybody has the right to have an opinion about everything, which, of course, they do. That's slightly different from the business of, you know, are people sceptical about what experts say? Now, when Fidel Castro died, I did some stuff which I believe to be utterly true about what an icon he was. I mean, that's quite aside from the fact that did he have people executed? Did he treat gays and Christians badly, which he certainly did? That doesn't stop you being a glamorous figure, the bad things you've done. But merely to say that he had a glamour to him brought down huge amounts of excrement on my head from particularly the right-wing people who wouldn't want to hear anything good spoken about him. So you're not allowed nowadays, well, you're not allowed, but I mean, you have to know what you're getting into if you say anything and have any opinion which others might disagree with.
And do you feel that was different in the past? Did you feel that you had more scope to give your take on a story or to put forward a certain view?
Yes, I do. But I'm not sure it was for any very noble or elevated reason. I think it was just simply that people that disagreed with you then had to find a writing paper, dear sir, I wish to, and find the address to write to complain either to you personally or to your boss or something like that. And so there were far fewer complaints. Now, anybody can just write a complaint on the internet and it's there for all time if you want it. It doesn't have to be accurate or anything, it's just there.
And does that then have an impact on your work or your colleagues' work? Do you fear that that will cow some people? Or is there an upside to this that actually you perhaps think a bit more about this and make sure, okay, well, I should be a bit more balanced or nuanced?
If it made me or anybody else think they've got to be more balanced or more nuanced, that is a good thing. Of course it is. Absolutely right. And it would be completely wrong for somebody like me to be unbalanced in some way. But I tend to think it just makes for more timidity and you're just more careful about what you say. You cut the adjectives out, you cut the sort of colourful stuff out because you just think this will bring a shower of complaint and accusation on me. I mean, I try not to let it affect me, but I can see it does affect me in some ways, and it affects, I think, all the broadcasters, not just the BBC. I think it affects every broadcaster, which is obliged to be balanced in its reporting, which includes you, of course.
Indeed. To a lesser extent, though. Does that worry you, then? Do you think that that's going to lead to more cautious journalism that perhaps doesn't go as far as it should?
I think it can cause that on outfits like the BBC, ITN, Sky, the ones that have got Ofcom hanging over them very, very, very much. I think they've all got to be careful. I noticed there was a thing by Gillian Reynolds in which she said she was writing with great praise about something that BBC Radio did about the election of Donald Trump and what it meant. And she said how wonderfully free-spoken and open they were. She said, what a shame the BBC didn't and wouldn't have done something like this about Brexit. And I think that is true. With foreign affairs, and thank God that's the field that I deal with, you can be more outspoken than you can on domestic affairs.
Do you think the BBC, in some aspects, failed on Brexit?
I don't want to just link it to the BBC. I mean, I think that all the broadcasters faced with a very fierce and difficult and at times technical argument took refuge in that old business of saying on the one hand, on the other. On the one hand, the Brexit people said this today. On the one hand, the Remain people said that today. And then it's as though they've done their job. And of course, we know that on both sides, there were amazing amounts of lies told. I mean, just kind of quite staggering stuff, quite cynical on both sides. And I don't feel the broadcasters really did enough to check that.
Are you not just doing that yourself now there? You just said balancing. On both sides.
But I think it was true on both sides. It really was true. That there was something called Project Fear. I suspect that some of the Project Fear elements will come true. But there was definitely an attempt to say to people, look, if you do this, you're going to be in deep dwang fairly soon. And, of course, the fairly got left out so that people were given the impression that from day one onwards, the sky would fall in. Well, I think it's possible the sky may fall in, but at some later stage. So there was hysteria and exaggeration, and certainly on the Leave side, a great, great deal of fear and lies, as we know. And in a sense, I think they did balance each other. Whether they balance each other literally word for word, lie for lie, exaggeration for exaggeration, I don't know. But it wouldn't surprise me entirely.
I want to ask you about war reporting. First of all, do you use that phrase? Are you comfortable with that phrase, war reporting, a war reporter?
I don't mind that. I don't like to present myself as a war reporter any more than, I mean, I could say I'm an election reporter or a foreign affairs disaster reporter. You know, wars are some of the things I do, but I do plenty of other stuff.
Over the time that you've covered conflicts, how have you changed as a person? Are you less gung-ho now? Are you more cautious?
I don't want to sound smarmy on this. It's very easy to get smarmy, but I've become much, much more sympathetic to the people that I report on. When I was young, I was much more inclined to be perhaps gung-ho in that sense, in the sense that, you know, racing in to sort of take sides and find the good guys and identify the bad guys, all that kind of stuff. I don't bother with that now. I mean, there are bad guys. There certainly are. There's no question about it. But, you know, they're usually bad guys for a reason. And when you know the reason, you understand things. You know, I mean, at the risk of being kind of lachrymose about it, which is always a bit of a danger, I've got a 10-year-old son, and you go to Mosul. I was on the outskirts of Mosul a couple of weeks ago. You know, they could be my son. Kids in hospitals, old people in hospitals could be me, you know. I used to be the kind of one that to go in there and people would say, how many people injured? Oh, I'd go around counting, you know, that one, the one with no legs, the one that looks as though he's just snuffed it. That makes, how many does that make, 25 or is it 26? And then you think, yeah, that's 26. That doesn't seem to matter, the sort of numbers game and the facts of it don't seem to matter. It's the emotion of it, or at least the feeling of it that matters to me now.
When you cover something like Mosul and, you know, the fight against ISIS in Iraq and in Syria, what do you see as your role in this? Do you see it as just, well, I'm simply there to report and that's that? Or do you have that hope that I will report this, people will see what's happening, and then something will change?
I do feel that, but I don't think it's my job to say how it should change. The danger with that, you see, is that you just start to report the stuff that will affect people in the way that you think they ought to be affected. And you can be very high-minded about it. You don't realize that you're cheating to do that. I think you've got to try to present things as openly and as honestly as you possibly can and stick it down in front of, a bit like, you know, an expert witness at a trial. You say, you tell the jury exactly to the best of your ability, the whole range of what you've seen. And you say, okay, now it's up to you.
During the Iraq war, you had a number of run-ins with the government at the time.
Mm.
What sort of pressure do you think they were trying to put on you, and what did you think you were trying to achieve?
I genuinely was trying to tell people. I was in Baghdad. I just felt, what's the point of being in a place if you don't say what's going on and what's happening? And it happened to kind of weaken their control and kind of support that they were getting from public, from the British public. If there was somebody there saying, actually, the bombing is making people more determined to resist, which is true. I mean, it's just a truism. I mean, it always happens like that. You know, they behave badly. Governments do tend to behave badly. It's nothing, you know, again, then there was a thing, oh, well, because it's a Labour government you're having problems with at the moment, you must be really on the right. Just as when I've had problems with Conservative governments, oh, you know, typical BBC lefty. Actually, that's just another stick that they pick up to whack you over the head with, really. But somehow or another, I don't like that. It's a bit whining to keep on like this. You know, I seem the hero of my own stories a bit too much.
You say you're the hero of your own stories a bit too much. Do you think you've played up to that a bit in the past?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Like, jokingly claiming you liberated Kabul, for example.
Yes, that was a really stupid thing. I didn't say I did it. I have to say I never said I did. And I wouldn't have, because there was a BBC team with me. And it's true. I mean, liberate the place, but we were the first people by far, by hours and hours and hours, into a very hostile or potentially hostile city. You just mustn't praise yourself. But, I mean, the amount of abuse that came my way, not from journalists, I think, but from editorial writers and so on, the ghastly Piers Morgan, all those kind of people who wouldn't know a city under siege if they tripped over it, you know.
Just be grateful it was pre-Twitter.
Yes, God, I would have had such a terrible time. What the hell? You know, it's not serious. I mean, I have to tell yourself that. I think a lot of journalists do feel that anyway, perhaps too much, that it's not serious. But, you know, it isn't life and death. It really, really isn't. And we have to kind of come to terms with that, I think, and accept that.
We're speaking at the moment as the city of Aleppo is in the midst of being destroyed, a war that's been going on for 5 years, 500,000 people killed. And there has been lots of excellent coverage over the last 5 years of what's happening in Syria, even with all the challenges that have been of reporting on that conflict. How does that make you feel as a journalist who has been covering, you know, this war in particular for the last 5 years, and nothing's changed?
If we know what's going on, that's as much as I feel I can do. And I confess I haven't actually been near Aleppo for a long time, and so it's not my reporting anyway. And I feel bad about that. I mean, I would really like to be there. It's difficult now. It is more difficult.
Well, indeed, on that point, is it, you know, we were talking about how things have changed and how everyone can know everything now because everyone has a smartphone, there's internet everywhere. And yet there are still places where it is almost impossible to report from, not just because they are war zones, but because journalists themselves have become targets. You know, in the past you might be collateral, so to speak, but now you could be targeted. Mm. How has that changed the situation for you?
Well, I mean, it's changed it for me and for a lot of others. It's funny, if you work for a big organisation, it's the organisation that gets spooked out by this. I'd be happy to go to Aleppo. Happy is probably not quite the right word, but I'd be more than willing to go. The BBC just won't send me, and I think they regard me particularly as a bit of a target, and, you know, they just don't want to preside over the probably quite unpleasant death of a journalist who's only there to do his or her job. We've had so much of that in the last 13 years since the invasion of Iraq that you can't blame newspapers and broadcasting organizations for wanting to say, listen, wait, you know, go maybe later, maybe go to Mosul later. We've had two really first-class reporters in correspondence in Mosul just in the last few weeks. So, I mean, there's no need for me to go. I don't like the thought that these things are going on and I can't see it for myself and work out what it is. But, I mean, when you compare, for instance, 2001, which is only 15 years ago, I got into Afghanistan. This was before the fall of Kabul, of course. I dressed up. It was rather kind of silly, really. But it worked, and I spent a couple of days...
Remind people how you dressed
I'm
up.
Well, I'm embarrassed. I dressed up in a burqa, and the cameraman and I... We were smuggled in by smugglers, cross-border smugglers, who said that the easiest, safest way was just wear a burqa and nobody will look at you, which was entirely true. I mean, I was the tallest woman in Afghanistan, but nevertheless, we drove around the place, so I hunched down and nobody looked at me, and we spent two really exciting and difficult but rewarding days in Taliban-controlled Afghanistan, and they'd warned that they would certainly capture and perhaps execute foreign journalists. But somehow or another, I knew the Taliban quite well in those days. I mean, it's changed a bit now, but, you know, I knew they wouldn't execute me. I knew it. I got friends in the top leadership of the Taliban. They were extremists, they were wild, they were stupid, they were crazy, all the above, but they were sort of moderately rational at the same time. Strange combo. And I just knew that I'd be safe. Now, well, Jihadi John is dead, thank God, and business of sawing off correspondents' heads seems to have sort of died away a bit, but the possibility is still very strong, and there's nobody on that side of things says, oh, you can't touch those people, they're journalists, they're trying to tell things as they are. You're just a Christian, you're a representative of Western governments, whatever they like to say about you.
And arguably you're less important to them now, because in the past you could say to them, well, look, I will get your story out to the world, I'll get your side out, and now they'll say, well, we have our own YouTube channel.
Well, they do. They can say that. But, I mean, also, I think, you know, when they're that extreme, they just feel they've got their own links to the Almighty. They don't need you to tell people. They're not interested in whether the people of Britain or the world are on their side or not. They feel that their side is right, whether people believe it or not. So why should they bother about putting their story out?
As we said at the start, you've worked at the BBC for 50 years. Are there stories that you look back on and you think, I wish I'd done that one differently, or I wish I'd got into that place at that time?
I don't think there's a story I've done that I didn't wish I'd done differently to some extent, or said different things, known more about. And I wish I'd got to places that I kind of wanted to go to but didn't put the effort in. When I look back on 50 years, it is mostly with a sense of kind of failure, of the places I didn't go to, the stories I didn't tell, the details I didn't put in. I'm very proud of what I've done. I don't mean to say I was sort of going around lashing myself. I mean, to have been, as I was, the only person in 1989, the only person on earth that was at Tiananmen Square, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the revolution in what was then Czechoslovakia, the revolutions in Bulgaria and Hungary and Poland, and then finally in Romania, and then went through a month, 2-3 weeks later or something, to see the release of Nelson Mandela in South Africa. There was only one person on earth who did all those things, and that was me. But it doesn't mean to say there are lots of things I feel I failed to bring out in my reports about those things. You can't know everything. You can't be all-knowing. And, you know, I've made lots and lots of mistakes, which I feel bad about. But at least I was there. At least I saw it.
And when you look forward, are there other stories that you are, you know, do you still have that list in your notebook of, if I could get on a plane tomorrow, here are a dozen places I go to, you know, these are the people I still want to get interviews with?
Oh, yeah, I've got the list. I gave it to my producer, and I had lunch yesterday, and we talked it all over. I mean, it's 25 years since I was in the kind of furthest recesses of the Amazon and found a tribe which had never seen anybody, wasn't an Amazonian Indian before. And 25 years ago, I want to go and see what's happened. I want to see if they've been affected by loggers and, you know, all the sort of evils that happen in Amazonia, or whether perhaps they're still as wonderful as I remember. That's 25th anniversary coming up this coming year, so that's definitely something I'm going to do.
If you were starting your career again today as a man in his early 20s who wanted to report on the world, what would you do? Would you try and work for an organisation? Would you try and work for the BBC? Would you send yourself off somewhere to freelance? What do you think your plan would be?
Yeah, I'd send myself off somewhere. I was kind of trapped in my early stages. No, that's a dreadful thing to say. I don't mean trapped. I mean, but I was kind of limited. I got married very young. I got married when I was still a student at Cambridge. And we had, after 3-4 years, we had a daughter and then another one after that. And I got a plum job with the BBC. I was really lucky. I walked out of Cambridge and walked into the BBC, into a job which within 4 years made me a foreign correspondent. But in a way, that all had constricted. What I should have done, I still so wish I'd done it. What I should have done is scraped together the money to have gone to Vietnam and just reported on Vietnam for a year, a couple of years. But, you know, I didn't want to leave my new wife. I didn't want to leave, especially when she was pregnant with our first and second kids. And of course, I didn't want to give up a really nice job. So in the long run, for me, it worked out very nicely. I mean, I've had a superb career, thanks to the BBC. I mean, it's not often I thank the BBC for anything, but, you know, it was because of them that I do this job. But certainly in those early years, I missed what I really should have done. So when people say to me, you know, what should I do? I want to do this. I always tell them, go and work for a radio station like this one, not a big organization, because you get stuck and lost in big organizations, but a nice small organization, and then get the basics, find out how you do the job, and then in a year or so, get the money together and go somewhere interesting. And then they say, where? And I think, well, what about somewhere like Burma? Deeply underreported, lots of things going on there, some of them bad, and not an awful lot. I mean, the Burmese government's so restrictive that it's really hard to get good correspondents there, into there. That's what I would do. Or other places. And take risks. You know, that was the other thing I didn't do at that stage. When I was young, I didn't take risks because I was a father of a pater familias, you know, with a nice pensionable job. Never made that mistake since.
John Simpson, thank you very much indeed. You've been listening to The Big Interview with me, Steve Bloomfield, in conversation with John Simpson. The Big Interview is produced and edited by Bill Lutie and researched by Guy Lutz. And that is it, I'm afraid, for this season of The Big Interview. But never fear, we'll be back next year with more inspiring names and stories from the world of current affairs, business, culture and design. Until next year, all that's left to say is goodbye and thank you very much for listening.